really been starved from hearing about the best evidences for the Christian faith. And I think they're getting excited. I appreciate your continued prayers, because I did talk to a couple of the pastors afterwards, and they're really quite intrigued by these open forums for skeptics that we do. And I think they might bite. That might be an opportunity for us to get that church encouraged to use science as a positive tool rather than a negative tool to present the gospel. So keep praying. Thank you. I'm going to start the class off with a discovery. It's actually a couple of discoveries. And we're going to finish Job 38. We'll get through it today. We haven't got that much more to go. We should do fine. and this discovery has to do with the first stars in the universe. And you've heard me speak about this before, how after the Big Bang creation event, the universe is expanding and it's cooling. And there's a brief episode in time in which you get the first stars forming. And these stars are unusual because they have to form without the benefit of metals. I mean, all you have in the early universe is hydrogen and helium. The universe about 4 minutes after the Big Bang is about 25% helium and 75% hydrogen. And the first stars that form, according to the Big Bang creation event, would be exceptionally massive. Because of the chemistry of the universe at that time, only very massive stars can form. They come in at about 200 to 300 times the mass of our star, the Sun. The W map is that map the expansion of the early history of the universe predicted that these stars would form when the universe is 200 million years old. This is what I would call indirect evidence for the first stars. And astronomers have longed to come up with direct evidence for the first stars. In other words, rather than just inferring what these first stars were like from looking at the radiation left over from the creation event, to actually observe them. And some critics of the Big Bang creation event have made the comment, well, if you can't see the first stars, then where's your proof that they really had these characteristics? And the typical response of the astronomers, well, is of course we can't see them. They form when the universe is only 200 million years old, which means that we have to look 13.5 billion light years away to get far enough back in time where we can actually see them. And objects 13.5 billion light years away are simply too dim to see. You're simply not going to see a single star at that great distance. And therefore, we're quite happy with the fact that we can't see these first stars. While a couple of Polish astronomers have said, not so fast, there may be a way that we can directly observe these first stars. And the point they make is that given that the universe is only hydrogen and helium at that point, as these very giant stars burn, unlike present-day stars, they lose very little mass. So the mass loss would be minimal, and that means that they will end up their burning cycle with virtually all of their mass. Well, any star that ends up its burning cycle with more than 1.4 times the mass of our star, the Sun, becomes a black hole. So with very high assurance, we recognize that these first stars born in the history of the universe would all become black holes. And we also know from the W map, the W map predicts that you're going to get about 800, somewhere between a few hundred up to a maximum of 1,000 stars per future galaxy clump of these giant stars forming. It's a rather small number. When you think of the fact that our galaxy has 200 billion stars, when you realize the first stars in our galaxy only numbered in the hundreds and not in the billions. So it's a small number of stars, but they're very big. And with them being several hundred per galaxy clump, you'd expect that a few of them would be binary. Which means you would have two of these supergiant stars orbiting around one another. And they would end up as black holes when the universe is only 200 million years old. And what these Polish astronomers calculated was the merger time for these firstborn stars, if indeed they had the characteristics that the indirect evidence from the W map tells us they would have. And what they determined is that quite a goodly number of them would have merger times that would be within the time span of the age of the universe. In other words, in 14 billion years, you'd expect a small number, a rather small number indeed, of these stars to experience a merge event. You say, how small? Well, it's the neighborhood of about a tenth of a percent, which means that, you know, there's less than a 50% chance that our galaxy would experience what that kind of event in the history of the universe. But there's lots of nearby galaxies around us. And one thing that their calculations demonstrate is that when these two black holes merge, and what we're talking about is under general relativity, these two binary black holes, these black holes going around with one another, would slowly spiral in together as they lose gravitational energy. And finally, they would merge. And what they published in their paper, this is in the June 10th issue of the Astrophysical Journal, as they calculated how much gravitational energy is released right at the merger event, and they said of all the events, gravitational events, that we can observe with our gravity wave telescopes, this kind of an event would produce the strongest burst of gravitational waves. So they said there are two bonuses here. Number one, this would be the easiest gravitational wave event for astronomers to detect, and if we detect this gravitational wave event, it would give us the first direct evidence for these first-generation stars. So we can't look far enough back in time to see them, but we can to see them when they were born and when they were burning. But if we wait long enough, we get to see them end as these two black holes would merge together. So this would give us a tool for directly probing the characteristics of these first-born stars. And this would actually tell us, by looking at the gravity waves, exactly what kind of Big Bang creation model we're looking at. They end their paper by looking at a list of different Big Bang creation models, and the variations they developed were dependent on how much and what kind the different components of exotic dark matter would be, whether the universe has a certain ratio of what they call cold dark matter to warm dark matter, and warm dark matter to hot dark matter. Those terms confuse you. There's about 38 different fundamental particles that astronomers hope to discover that would be the base of exotic matter, the matter that doesn't strongly interact with radiation. And by the way, we've detected one already, namely neutrinos. But we know they don't make up a very large fraction of the exotic matter. If you listen to our Creation Date Update webcast this Tuesday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., we are going to be featuring the particle physicist Michael Strauss from the University of Oklahoma. He's going to tell us about some recent papers that indicate that we may be detecting axions. And axions are even tinier than neutrinos. But axions have the potential of actually explaining the majority of the exotic matter in the universe. So if you want to listen to that, that's 11 a.m. If you haven't a chance to listen to it live, we do archive the show and you can listen to it at your convenience. But this would give us the strongest burst of gravity waves, which is exciting for all the two gravity wave detectors that are out there and the new ones that we're planning to build. Now, what I want to share with you, because it's something in the future, what these Polish astronomers calculated is that, you know, given the physics that we understand of these first-born stars, these are the kinds of gravitational events we should observe. They're well within the capability of the gravity wave telescopes that we have, and it will tell us which of the different Big Bang models is actually correct, because each one would predict slightly different characteristics for these first-born stars. But the bottom line is it would significantly strengthen the evidence that indeed the universe was created by a transcendent being, a timeless finite. The Big Bang model is basically correct. And then the design we see there points to the supernatural creator. Now, I want to talk to you about an American study. This is done by six American astronomers, and it's part of the WMAP team. Now, what you heard with the WMAP is that this was a NASA satellite that measured very carefully the radiation left over from the creation event. And what got all the hype, what was called the microwave background, the cosmic microwave background. So this is the background radiation, the radiation left over from the creation event that we see at microwave wavelengths, radio wavelengths. The team has now done the more difficult work of analyzing the infrared cosmic background. And what they see in the infrared cosmic background are a lot of anisotropies, little bumps in the infrared signal. And they've been mystified for some time by these bumps in the infrared signal. And these six American astronomers say, we think we can explain these bumps in the infrared map of the cosmic background radiation as the result of population 3 stars, another name for the firstborn stars in the history of the universe. And what they do is they take these firstborn stars, you know, looking at what the W map had already determined in terms of the mass of these firstborn stars, and they ran models on what the life cycle of a 200 to 300 solar mass star would look like. It actually burns up in less than 100,000 years, so it burns up quite rapidly. And like all stars, when it runs out of its fuel, it cools off. And so it's kind of like an ember on an open fire. You burn a log, and the log runs out of fuel, and then you've got this glowing ember that takes hours to burn down. And that's the same thing with stars. Our star, for example, after it burns up all of its fuel, will take another 100 billion years to cool off as a white dwarf. It goes into the cinder phase, and it cools off very slowly. Well, they point out in this paper that with these stars being 200 to 300 times the mass of our star, the Sun, they will take a very long time to cool off, and they leave a particular kind of infrared signature. And they said these anisotropies in the infrared cosmic background is exactly what we expect if the universe indeed produced a population of 200 to 300 solar mass stars, where you get about 200 to 1,000 such stars in each galaxy seed. And the anisotropies they're seeing fits that description very well. So they're saying, we think we've got a direct detection of these stars. But what they're really detecting is kind of the afterglow, the infrared afterglow from these stars. So in the context of the Polish study and the American study, we can no longer say that no one has ever detected these firstborn stars. These are detections of the firstborn stars. I think it's very comforting for a creationist to recognize that it's telling us that these stars have the characteristics that we would expect, given that the universe had a birth date in finite time, where the universe is expanding from that point of beginning, like the prophet Isaiah, Jeremiah, Zechariah, and Job predicted thousands of years ago. Remember our study in Job chapter 9 where we talked about it. All right, this will be written up for today's New Reason to Believe. So if you go to our website at reasons.org, in the next few days you'll see this all described for you. And if you care, it'll actually take you right to the Astrophysical Journal website where you can read the paper for yourself. If you have that kind of enjoyment, you can do that. We try to do that with every new reason that we post every day on our website. We give you a little description in layman's language what it's all about, how it ties into the Christian faith, gives additional support for the Christian faith. But for those who are interested, they can go straight to the original source and see for themselves what's been going on. So with that, let's turn over our Bibles to the book of Job, chapter 38. And one of the things we've been talking about in Job 38 is that in addition to God speaking directly to Job and trying to bring about some resolution to this debate that Job has had with his four friends, I'd also conclude that the Lord is not only answering Job out of the storm, verse 1, he's speaking to all five of the men that are gathered here. And part of what he does in bringing these questions to Job and his friends and basically saying, you've been debating all these weeks now about creation and about who I am. Let me ask you some questions. You guys think you're so smart, see how well you do at answering these questions. And is also driving home several significant theological points. That's something we haven't covered in the text yet, that when you go through Job 38, the Lord is not only trying to bring some humility to these five men in their discussions about him and creation, he's actually raising theological issues that are part of the debate they have with one another. We're going to cover one of those today, how they debate one another about death. And so he asks them a question about death to make some points here. So that's part of what's going on here in Job 38. is that the Lord is responding to a lot of the debate points in the previous 37 chapters. By the way, this is the first time that the Lord speaks to these five men, and he goes on speaking for several chapters, as we'll notice. But one of the things he does here in Job 38 that we've been commenting on for the past several weeks is he's giving us a reflection on the six creation days of Genesis 1. Actually takes us through each of the creation days. And this is the first of three poetic texts that do that. Two others are Psalm 104 and Proverbs chapter 8. And because they're poetic passages, it doesn't do it in the strict chronology that we see in Genesis chapter 1. And we've covered creation days 1, 2, 3, and 4, introduced creation day 5 last week. We're going to finish creation day 5 today. And there's just one paragraph that deals with creation day 6. And then we'll get into Job 39. And Job 39 really answers the question about the origin of the soul. I mean, you know, Fuzz Ron and I have brought out a book on the origin of life. One of the things I've been talking to our scholar team about is, you know, our publisher, Nav Press, has this plan that we'll have a book on the origin of life. We're bringing out a book next year on the origin of humanity. And they want to repackage the Creator and the Cosmos with the theme, the origin of the universe. And I've been talking to our scholars, we really need to bring in a book on the origin of the soul. Now, I'm not so much talking about the human soul as if we see in creation day 5 when God creates soulless creatures, the nephesh creatures, the birds and the mammals that have been endowed by God with the quality of mind, will, and emotions. And I think it'd be good to bring in a book on the origin of the soul because that's something the evolutionists always duck. You know, they'll talk about the origin of life, they'll talk about the fossil record, but where does this mind come from? Where does this will that these animals manifest come from? You know, they say it all evolves from the physics of the chemistry of life, but can you really answer the origin of the soul just by looking at the molecules and the atoms? I don't think so. Someone needs to bring a book out on this, but actually a book already exists. It's the book of Job. So maybe all we could do is make it a really short book and then just give them Job 38 and 39. That's kind of what we're going to be looking at as we jump into 39 as a whole theme, the origin of the soul, and what the soul is really like in these different animals, how it's different for different creatures. And really what we see in Job 39 is talking about the soul in the context of how God created these soulless creatures, different soulless creatures, to benefit human beings in different ways. The soul isn't always manifested in the same fashion in each of these creatures. But we're getting ahead of ourselves here. Let me jump back to creation day 5. The first text that mentioned this is verses 16 to 18, and then it's also picked up in verse 36. And creation day 6 is covered in verses 36 to 41. By the way, if you want 1, 2, 3, and 4, you can get the tapes of the previous messages we've given here in the class. So when we do 36 to 41, we're going to cover creation days 5 and 6 together. But let's look at what we see here in 16 to 18. Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the shadow of death? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. So this is a challenge that he's giving to the five men. You know, this is one thing they've left out of their debate with one another about creation. They've not discussed these issues. They talk about death. But he brings up the whole point. You know, you're talking about all this life that exists on the planet Earth. So have you ever gone to the springs of the deep and observed the life that exists there? It's very different than the life that we see on the seashore. And he says, you know, you haven't been there. Well, today's scientists have been there, and they indeed have discovered what the Lord is saying here in Job 38, that life looks very different at these deep sea vents than it looks elsewhere in the shallow parts of the ocean. And likewise, there's life in the deep part of the ocean, even away from the sea vents, the steam vents, than exists elsewhere in the ocean. And it says, have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? And this is kind of a theme you see in Genesis chapter 1. But as you go through Genesis chapter 1, we see that God is filling the earth with life. You know, life first in the oceans, then life on the kind of the land masses. Then you get into creation days 5 and 6. It talks about how he creates these creatures in the oceans. swarms of small sea creatures and then the soulless creatures in the oceans, then he fills the air with life. And the point that's being made here in Genesis 16, 17, and 18, no matter where you go here on the earth, you're going to see the life that I've created. The whole of the earth is filled with my life, is what the Lord is saying here. And then the whole point about death here, you know, how many of us have actually done scientific research on the gateways to death? Well, we haven't. We haven't been there. What I want to do here is take off on this, because this is something that's been discussed previously in the book of Job, but to actually go beyond the book of Job and see what the Bible says about the gateways of death and how they're different for different animal life forms. The gateway of death is not the same for us as it is for the birds and mammals, as it is for the lower animals, as it is for the plants. And, you know, everybody wants to talk these days about near-death experiences. Ever run into someone at a party you've been to and they bring up the issue of near-death experience? The Bible's got a lot to say about near-death experiences. By the way, most of what you hear at a party about near-death experiences is bogus, so you might want to be apprised of that, but it's interesting how it shows up here in the book of Job, because everybody wants to know what that's like. And it's a good way to open up a door for communication of gospel truth. Well, let me get back to the theme that life is everywhere. You know, some fairly new scientific discoveries and quite surprising discoveries is we expected life to be in the air. Birds are there. But as we go higher up in the atmosphere, we've been amazed at how high up in the atmosphere life goes. The fact that you can actually see birds flying in the stratosphere. Nobody knew that birds could do that. But they found some species of birds flying in the stratosphere, the lower stratosphere. But you know, the lower stratosphere doesn't have much oxygen in it. The fact that these birds can fly there at all is utterly amazing. We're talking 30,000 feet. You've got birds flying. I don't know why they fly that high. Maybe someone here knows more than I do about this, but because it's there, right? As far as I know, the insects don't get that high. Or well, usually they're predator birds, but that's all the more interesting. Why would you get predator birds up that high? And you know, the dope on this in the literature is that these are just predator birds that catch these updrafts, and they just love to fly on these updrafts, and so they just kind of lazily let these things carry them up there, and they get up that high, and then they just kind of coast all the way down. It's very cold. It's extremely cold and very little air, and the big mystery is how do these birds possibly adapt themselves to the altitude change? I mean, you know, we do hear people going to the top of Mount Everest without oxygen, but it takes them 40 to 50 days to adapt to those conditions. And then when they get up there, they don't do very well. I mean, the death rate's quite high for people who get above 26,000 feet without oxygen. And yet these birds seem to be quite all right. And I don't think they take 40, 50 days to adapt to that altitude. And, of course, as you mentioned, it's extremely cold. You know, those of you who have been in the aircraft realize that sometimes the pilot gives you the outside temperature. And it'll be anywhere from 30 to 60 below zero. So, but these birds are up there, and they're doing okay. But the other reason is, you know, why would they bother to fly that high? But I'm just bringing it up to make the point. And, you know, life really is prolific on planet Earth. Everywhere you go, you see life. Yeah, comment. Oh, I didn't know that. So spiders get up there. Gee. That's what the birds are eating. There you go. Just solved the problem there. But the other thing they've discovered with these high-altitude balloon experiments is that you get diatoms up as high as 100,000 feet. So even 100,000 feet in the atmosphere, we see evidence of life. And, of course, what's also new is that they're finding them deep in the crust. You know, in South Africa and the coal mines and the Canadian deep coal mines, they're finding that there's bacteria 2 miles below the surface of the Earth. And so, you know, people never thought that life could exist that deep underground, but it's there. And, of course, what's happening is that you get the evolutionists looking at all this and saying, well, that just shows that life must originate very easily everywhere, because we're seeing life in all these extreme conditions. The high upper atmosphere, the very low depths of the Earth, the steam vents. We call these life forms extremophiles. They're existing under extreme conditions. And they actually conclude that because they exist under these extreme conditions, that demonstrates that they must have evolved under those extreme conditions, and therefore it doesn't take any miraculous input to make this life. The Book of Job, I think, is putting a different perspective on it, is that, you know, look at how great and marvelous God is, that he can create life that exists under these extreme conditions. And I don't know whether I shared with you in the class here a couple of months ago, but there's been a paper published in the journal, it's the International Journal of Astrobiology, a brand new journal. And the lead article in the first issue of that journal was the point that extremophiles are irrelevant to the origin of life. And the whole argument was that, you know, trying to get these chemicals to come together under these extreme conditions is orders of magnitude more difficult than trying to get them to come together in what they call mesophilic conditions, the kinds of ordinary conditions where we typically see life, like on the surface of the Earth, where there's water around, and when the temperature is above 70 degrees Fahrenheit. And that point is true. It's something that's brought out in our Origins of Life book, that, you know, when you go deep underground or you go into the high atmosphere or the steam vent, the chemistry there completely shuts down any possibility that these chemicals could come together to make a life form. So rather what it demonstrates is the point here in the Book of Job, the fact that we see life literally everywhere on the earth, above the earth, and in the earth is evidence of the miraculous power of the Creator, and the fact that he can create life that can survive under those incredibly extreme conditions. And that's the challenge he's bringing to these five men. He says, look, everywhere you go on this planet, you're going to find my handiwork, evidence for my miraculous creation of these life forms. They didn't know that then, but we're discovering that today, that literally everywhere there's life. It's in the ice. You can go to Greenland and you can find life in the ice. You can find life existing under freezing conditions, conditions that are permanently freezing. You know, there are bacteria out there that we call antifreeze bacteria. They've got these chemicals inside that actually act as an antifreeze and allow them to exist under those conditions. They've found life that exists at 100 degrees above the boiling point of water. Actually, it's not fair to say the water isn't boiling. It's water under very high pressure. And because it's under very high pressure, it doesn't boil, even though it's 3 to 350 degrees Fahrenheit. But life is able to exist under those conditions. And again, what we're seeing is that God creates these special proteins that allow these life forms to survive under those extreme conditions. There is a cost, however. Under these extreme conditions, these life forms are less active than they are. So, you know, we are active life. And because we don't have to live under extreme conditions, we're able to have long lifespans and an active life during those long lifespans. It's not the case for these extremophiles, which is another argument against the fact that they could be naturalistic. Well, I want to bring up the other theme, and that's the gates of death. And again, that might be the theme of a good book to write, because that's a question that the evolutionists always duck. I mean, here they're trying to explain life from a naturalistic perspective. What about the challenge of explaining death? Well, what we see here in the Bible is that death is different for different species of life, especially the human species. The book of Ecclesiastes, which we will eventually get to, that's one of the creation accounts on our list, is four chapters in the book of Ecclesiastes. It makes the point that, well, this isn't going to go down with a lot of pet lovers. You know, in terms of the negative mail we get at Reasons to Believe, high up on the list is the mail we get from pet lovers who are disturbed by our comments that when pets die, they return to the dust, that there isn't a doggy heaven, and that you're not going to see your dog in the new creation. By the way, I'm not claiming that there will not be dog or dog-like creatures in the new creation. I'm just saying that they're not going to be the dogs we see here on the face of the earth. But part of where we get that is from the book of Ecclesiastes, which makes the point that except for the human species, other animal life species, when they die, that's the end of their existence. But human beings are different. We are spiritual. And because we are spiritual, once we're created, our existence continues forever. So the stars will burn out. The universe will disappear. Your dogs and cats will be gone. But you will live forever. And everyone, every human being, is going to live forever, whether they like it or not. You know, some would wish that they wouldn't live forever, but we're all going to live forever. So in that context, I would conclude that those in hell experience the torments of hell literally for the rest of eternity, because they are spiritual. And when God creates a spiritual being, that being is a permanent. It's eternal from that point onward. But that's not true of the animals. When the animals die, they return to the dust. So there's a difference. The other thing we get from John chapter 16 is that God's Holy Spirit ministers grace to all human beings. And part of that grace is He implants within us not only the law on our conscience. I mean, everyone knows the Ten Commandments, not because God gave it to Moses, but because God has written the Ten Commandments on the heart of every human being. And He's written the great commandments on our heart. You know, that we are to love our neighbors as ourselves. We're to love God above all. That's all been written on our heart. Every human being has that. But John 16 makes the point there's something else that God has written upon our heart. And that's the knowledge that judgment is coming. And therefore, when we human beings face death, we face death with a certain knowledge that we will be judged for our life. Whereas that when a dog or a cat dies, it dies peaceably with the comfort that there's no judgment. So for the dogs and cats, there's no final exam. And therefore, the threat of death is nothing like it is for a human being. And again, that's something that the Lord is bringing out here about the gates of death being shown to you. He's just saying, look, if you just look at the different animals, you notice that they react to death differently than we human beings. The soulish animals react to death differently than the non-soulish animals. Because what the soulish animals are anticipating, and sometimes I've had a dog that knew that death was coming. There were several days when the dog seemed to clearly realize that the demise was just around the corner. And maybe I was reading something into it, but I had a sense that that dog was going through emotional trauma, recognizing that the relationship he had with us, his human masters, was about to end. And of course, we were going through the same emotions, so maybe we're putting that on the dog, who knows. But in one sense, I think it's reasonable that the death experience of birds and mammals is different because they are soulish. They're capable of forming emotional bonds and relationships with other animals. With one another and with humans. And the bonds they form with humans are especially strong. Because we're spiritual, I think God endows us with the capacity to form an exceptionally strong bond with these creatures. And so in anticipation of death, there is that emotional trauma of recognizing there will be a loss. On the other hand, when a dog dies, there's no fear of judgment. There's no anticipation of a great test or an examination at the end of their life. Yes. Right. Well, you bring up an interesting point, and because I've seen that with the pets I've had, and from a non-Christian perspective, you observe this and say, well, aren't they experiencing sin too? And this reflects back to Romans 5:12, where it says, death through sin entered the human species, and all men died. And then there's been this big debate, well, is there death of animals before Adam sins or not? And I've run into people who claim, well, look, it's quite clear that these animals are experiencing sin because of the shame and the guilt that they experience. And therefore, sin is not just us human beings. And that when Jesus died on the cross, he was dying for the cats and the dogs as well as for human beings. It's a doctrine that's actually in print. In fact, one organization wants to change the creation creeds of the church to accommodate that. So the question your son is asking is really a serious question for our day. A lot of Christians are just kind of ignoring this and saying, this is ridiculous. But no, this is a seriously held issue today. But what I'd like to suggest is that these responses we see in our pets are evidence of the strong bond they have with us. I believe that when God created these nephesh creatures, he endowed them with a strong desire to relate to us and to form bonds with us. It's not just that God endowed them with mind, will, and emotion so they could relate. It seems like God endowed them with a desire to please human beings. And, I may be wrong on this issue, but I got relatives in Canada, and they see this in the wild animals. I myself have taken vacations in the North Canadian Rockies where I think I see evidence of this. I'll tell you a quick story. I got a cousin on Vancouver Island, and in his younger days, he loved to go fishing in the Georgia Strait, and he had all these favorite fishing places. He was the one that got a salmon for Kathy in just 30 minutes. I mean, he knew the place so well. He said, "Tell me what fish you want. You'll have it on your hook within 30 minutes. Halibut, salmon, ling cod, whatever. I'll get it for you." And he actually pulled that off. But what he discovered over the course of a couple of years is he'd be out there fishing in his rowboat, and suddenly this huge gray whale came right up beside his rowboat out of nowhere. And the gray whale kind of rolled over right there. He was worried he was going to get capsized by this thing. And a couple of visits later, he realized that gray whale wanted human contact. And so he began stroking this gray whale. And so he wound up making friends with this wild gray whale. And he later discovered it was a female because a year later it came up with a cub and wanted the cub to have this attention. Now that gives you a whole different sense of what it must have been like during the whaling days. Here God has endowed these very intelligent creatures. Whales are really intelligent. And if you've ever been to SeaWorld, you realize how much those killer whales like to please human beings. And if you ever go down into the tank, they seem to get a great kick out of splashing everybody. And they like to please the crowd. And that to me is the trauma of the whaling era. Here God created these creatures with this incredible desire to relate to human beings. And what do? We kill them off. Took advantage of the fact that they want it. Hunting whales is easy because they seek you out. And so, anyway, that's kind of off the track. But the whole point is, when we have a dog in our home and form this relationship with us, God has endowed that creature. God has endowed that dog. I got to watch my words here. God has endowed that dog with a very strong desire to please its human masters. And so when it has an accident, and that's what I would call these things, not sins, but accidents. They live under the second law of thermodynamics like we do, so there will be accidents and random events that depart from the norm. But when that happens, they feel this sense that, whoops, I've displeased my human owners. And the reaction we're seeing is their recognition that they have brought displeasure upon us when God has endowed them with a very deep sense to please us. So, and by the way, it tells us in the ninth chapter of Genesis that when God gave man the right to eat meat, at that point he put the fear of God upon, the fear of man upon the animals, so they would have some self-protection. But one of the things my relatives have noticed, and I see myself, if you go to places in the world where there hasn't been any human contact, you will have an opportunity to run across birds and mammals where you're the first human visitor they've ever seen. And what I've experienced is that same sense. They want to be around you. They'll come right up to you. They show no fear. And you can touch them. You can pet them and stroke them. But once they've had some negative experiences with human beings, that fear quickly comes upon them and they avoid you. That's one of the things I enjoyed about one backpacking trip I made in the North Canadian Rockies, is actually get into places where humans rarely go. They visit there maybe once every 20 years. And when you come into contact with these animals, you get to see these things. I think a lot more research needs to be done on this. And I'm admitting that I'm speculating here. I could be way off base here. On the other hand, I think there is some scriptural support for the fact that God indeed created these animals for the enjoyment of the human species. Genesis 1, I think, hints at that. Yes. Right. Right. I think you're making a strong point there. Nevertheless, I do hear stories all the time about, you know, just like we heard here, about where a dog feels what looks to us like deep shame for committing an offense. And I say, doesn't that mean that they're experiencing a sin the same way we are? That's exactly it. And there's something in the Levitical law that sheds light on this, and it talks about how if a cow that's gone horns has the habit of goring other creatures, the owner of that cow is to be warned and rebuked for this behavior, indicating that the owner is responsible for this ugly behavior of the cow. And how that behavior continues, the cow is to be destroyed, and the owner as well is to be destroyed. Now, I think that's evidence that God really has endowed these birds and mammals with a capacity to please human beings. And the warning there in the book of Leviticus is that this desire is so strong that you need to be careful that you don't abuse that quality that God has endowed in these creatures, because it can go negative as well as positive. We can form a relationship with, say, a wild wolf, and tame that wolf, for that wolf expresses a lot of love to human beings. But we can also form a relationship with a wolf where we train that wolf to be a vicious attack animal. And so our negative behavior or treatment of that animal, like for example, if you beat up a dog every day of its life, then that dog is going to be very mean towards every other humans that it comes into contact with. So negative behavior. And see, why do these animals pick up on negative behavior? They're trying to please their owners. But if they have a really wicked owner, guess what's going to happen to the animal? And that's why God said, if an animal develops behavior that is negative, then its owner must be exceptionally wicked, and therefore the owner is to be stoned to death as well as the animal in the context of the Levitical law. And I think that's something we need to be aware of, is that really vicious animals probably have really vicious owners. But really loving pets probably really have really loving owners. In fact, that's something I used to do with people that were part of our evangelism. In fact, I look in the room here and I can see a few of you who are part of our evangelism team here when I was a full-time evangelism minister. Chris was with us back in those days. And that's one of the things I used to do with our people I was training here in the church, was to say, when you walk up to a door, total stranger, if you happen to run into one of the pets before you get to the door, examine carefully the behavior of the pet. That'll give you a good clue what kind of person you're going to be talking to, all right? So, if you're worried about your life, then be a little bit cautious with the owner of that creature. In terms of this whole theme of near-death experiences, I'm going to take you to three Bible passages that talk about near-death experiences. Then I want to share with you a little bit about one of our pastors here who has had a lot of experience in this area and some of the insights that he has shared with me. And one place to go to is Psalm 23, verse 4. Let's see if I can find that. Here we go. King David is speaking here, and he says, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. What's interesting here is the same phrase that you see in Job 38. The very same phrase. So Job certainly preceded the writings of Psalms. So he says, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Now the point that David is making here, that if you are a follower of God, this is not a guarantee for all human beings, but it's a promise to followers of God. If you are a follower of God, if your life is submitted to Jesus Christ, when you cross that threshold of death, you will not cross that threshold of Psalm 23. When it comes your time as a believer to die, you will not die alone. I mean, isn't that one of the great fears of death? When you die, you have to say goodbye to all your friends. And the point here in Psalm 23, when you die, you will not die alone. You will get an escort. God himself will escort you across that threshold. You know, that's got to be one of the comforting things. What he says, your rod and your staff will comfort me. You know, the Lord himself will show you the way and make the proper introductions once you get across that threshold. Now, another place you can go to is a Psalm 139. Here we go. King David is again speaking. He says, my frame was not hidden from you when it was made in a secret place, when it was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. And here he's referring to his conception in his mother's womb. And he's making the point here that, you know, God is involved in forming his personhood in the womb at the point of conception. This is one of the passages you can go to in addition to another psalm by David, Psalm 51:5, where he says, I was a sinner from the time I was conceived in my mother's womb. Now, if he's a sinner from the time he was conceived in his mother's womb, he was a spiritual being. And here in Psalm 139, he makes the point that God himself is the one that's forming the personhood of that of the human at the point that the human is conceived in his or her mother's womb. He's ordained from that very point. That's when he becomes a person. And these are really the two passages of scriptures I would go to for this whole issue of is it right for a woman to abort her fetus? This point is telling us that human life begins at the point of conception. The man and the woman are responsible for putting that physical egg together, which will become a human being. But God is the one that's responsible for creating the soulishness and the spirit, the real personhood of the creature. After all, our existence as a human being really doesn't have much to do with the body in which we live. Now, I kind of look at the physical body in which we all live as automobiles. Okay, we've been given a body that carries around our soul and spirit. And when our body dies, that's not the end of us. What happens is that we go to be with the Lord, and later on he gives us a new vehicle. We will get a new body. And so we need to look at our physical bodies as simply the equipment of automobiles. What happens when your automobile wears out and is no longer usable? You throw it away and you get a new one. Well, this is what's going to happen with us. So that point is made here in Psalm 139 that our personhood is not in the physical flesh in which we reside. The physical flesh really enables our spirit and soul to move around. It gives us the capacity to communicate with one another. But the point that's interesting here is what follows. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days adorned for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. So something else we can take comfort in is the fact that not only when the day of death comes to each of us, and it will, we will get this escort across that threshold. You've given your life to Christ, you will not die alone, you will be escorted by the Lord himself across that threshold of death. And the other thing that we can take comfort in is that long before God formed us in the wombs of our mother, long before we were conceived, God had it already recorded on his calendar the very day we would die. So how long we will live has all been ordained before the time that God created us in our mother's womb. So in that sense, that takes away a lot of trauma for the believer because, you know, we look at that and say, well, you know, how long are we going to live? And we all worry about whether our life is too short or too long. Psalm 139 says you don't need to have concern for that. God already preordained this before you were even conceived. So how many days I will live is totally in His control. If my life is cut short early, that's because of His doing, and He's got a purpose for my life being cut short early. If He intends to keep me on this lousy planet for 20 more years than I want to be, well, that's in His control too. And I say lousy in the sense that we all realize we're headed for a far better place. And sometimes as we get older, we're in a hurry to go home. But God has ordained how many days He will live. And if He has a reason for us to live to be 110 instead of the 75 or 80 that we want to live, He's got a reason for that. And we can take comfort in the fact that He indeed has that reason. Hand back here and over here. How do you deal with suicide? Well, this brings up the whole issue of free will and predestination. Okay, it tells us here in Psalm 139 that before we were conceived in the womb, God had determined exactly how many days, hours, and minutes I would live. Does that mean that I'm free to eat these quadruple hamburgers with cheese and bacon on it every day of my life and, you know, load my arteries up with cholesterol? Because after all, God has predetermined how many days I will live. I don't have to bother doing any exercise. I can play video games all day. And by the way, this has come up with my boys because I would like to see their health habits improved a little bit, right? And I'm saying, you know, I don't want to outlive you guys, but the way you're living, I'm worried I'm going to outlive you. And the whole point there is God does expect us to exercise our free will to take responsibility. So in one sense, I think there's a context for God seeing one of the saints come through the thresholds of death and say, you know, I really didn't want to escort you across this threshold this early, but the way you lived your life, I had to take you across this threshold because you didn't take care of yourself. So I think there's validity for that. I think that's where suicide comes in, is that God really does hold us responsible to exercise our free will to make wise and godly choices. But that raises what's called the conundrum of free will and predestination. How can God hold us personally responsible for our decisions and yet claim to have predetermined every word, every thought we think, every action we perform? Well, one of the books that are on the table is called Beyond the Cosmos. And we show you that the answer to that cannot be found if you try to resolve free will and predestination in the context of just the dimensions we humans experience, length, width, height, and time. God transcends this universe. And in the realm or the dimensionality of His transcendence, there are several different ways you can resolve that paradox where human free choice is totally upheld and at the same time God's predetermination of every event, thought, and word is also totally upheld. They're only apparently contradictory if you presume that God is limited in His actions in the same way that we are limited. If you allow God to be as big as He is, you can, quote, have your cake and eat it too, which means you're not absolved from personal responsibility. Yes. Well, a comment on people that wind up dying before they come out of their mother's womb or wind up dying when they're only a few months old or are severely handicapped when they're born and, you know, only live to be 3 or 4 but never reach the point where they can read or write, what happens to them? Well, I think this verse also applies that for each one of them, every day has been ordained for them. However, I'd be cautious. This has actually crept into the life movement where they say, well, you know, one of the good things about all these aborted babies is they all go to heaven. And I say, no, wait a minute. God ordained every day for them. That doesn't absolve you from the responsibility of not preserving the life of your unborn child. But if you go to John chapter 1 and John chapter 3, the Gospel of John, it makes the case there that God's light, I think it's referring to His spiritual light, which is defined in the first letter of John, 1 John makes the point that God is light. Says that right at the opening of the first epistle. And then it breaks down what God's light is all about. It says God's light is love, life, and truth. Those are the three components of God's light. And that's kind of what the Trinity is bestowing upon us as human beings. The Son gives light. The Holy Spirit reveals truth. And the Father bestows His love upon us as human beings. But it says that that light in John 1 and John 3 is bestowed upon every human being. Man, woman, child, fetus, every human being receives that light. And if that human being receives that light, accepts it as being true, receives that light, receives that love, they will proceed towards salvation. But if they reject that light, they will proceed towards condemnation. Moreover, it makes a promise. If anyone receives of God's light, he will get more light from God. But if he rejects that light, he'll receive even less light from God. So we'll all be judged based on what light, what we've done with the light that God has given us. I see implied in John 1 and John 3 that somehow God has been able to communicate that light even to a fetus that's only 3 days past conception. Now exactly how he pulls it off, I have no idea. But I think from an anthropomorphic perspective, we figure, well, you know, no one can receive the gospel of salvation from Jesus Christ unless they've read this book, or at least they've heard a verbal communication of the gospel. I think God is stronger than that. I think God can get across His truth in ways beyond that. And I think what kind of confuses us here is our evidence is based on what we can see. Okay, now, if God gives you a child that He is ordained will receive 85 years of life, then He doesn't have to use the same methods of bestowing His life upon that child as He would upon a child that He knows is only going to live 3 days past conception. In other words, God's got different means to communicate to different people. He knew ahead of time that I would receive a university education. So in that sense, He could use intellectual means for communicating the gospel to me that He wouldn't use to someone who's severely retarded. He's going to use different methods. And to me, the evidence is the fact that I think it must work for the fetus because we can observe directly that it works for severely retarded adults who have no capability of reading, some who have no capability of even verbal communication. And yet, when you observe these individuals, it seems quite evident that they've received salvation from the Lord. Now, if they can pull it off, God must have a way to get it through to other people. Now, I'll be the first to admit this is a hotly disputed doctrinal idea within the Christian community. Lots of reputable Christian scholars would strongly dispute my conclusions and would argue that there really is, quote, an age of accountability. Okay, I'm just asking us to, you know, really be cautious about whatever conclusions we draw there. I think Scripture's got something to say about this, and we have to be especially cautious not to abuse our understandings on this issue to make some wrong doctrinal deductions about, say, the abortion issue. I've got to be careful there. Okay, I'm not going to finish. I thought I was going to be able to wrap this up. But the passage I want to get to next time is the example that we see in Acts, where God actually speaks to Stephen as he goes through the threshold of death. And then I want to get you into some anecdotal evidence from pastors who've had a lot of experience in dealing with people on the verge of death. The difficulty in these near-death experiences is that most people, when they're at the threshold of death, are communicated with the Lord, but they're not communicated with us. You know, it's quite typical that when people are dying of natural causes, they're in a comatose state when they're at the threshold of death. And so we're sitting there watching them die, and we can't tell what's going on. But I think the anecdotal evidence that's relevant is when people cross that threshold fully capable of communicating with us. And that's kind of some of the anecdotal evidence I want to bring next week, which I think bears out these scriptures that we're seeing in Psalm 139, Psalm 23, and also in Acts chapter 8. There are other examples. We'll get to them next week. Let's bow for a word of prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you that there's so much in this Bible that offers us some comfort and reassurance about the soon demise that each one of us will face. And Lord, may we be fairly warned by Psalm 139 that no matter how young we are, we're going to be at the threshold of death very quickly. This life will be over so soon. And Lord, help us to count our days as you count our days. And but Lord, may we be properly prepared that when we come to that threshold, we will receive a comfort for you. And Lord, may we be emissaries of that comfort to other people. Father, we all know non-Christians who fear death. In fact, most of our non-Christian friends don't want to talk about death because they fear it so much. Father, I pray that you would give us the grace and the love and the humility to approach our non-Christian friends in such a way that they'll want to talk to us about the subject of death. And Lord, may you equip us to be a source of comfort there, to encourage them that there is a way where death can be a lot less frightening for them if they will only commit their lives to Jesus Christ. Help us to use this as a witnessing tool. And we thank you too, Lord, for the birds and the mammals that you've created to enjoy this planet with us. Thank you, Lord, in the way that they bring tremendous enjoyment into our lives. And Father, may we fully grant you the credit that you deserve for creating those creatures to so richly endow our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.